Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 49. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Laird Schaub, Executive Secretary of the Fellowship for Intentional Community. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue after the interview. The Fellowship for Intentional Community, or FIC, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting cooperative culture. FIC believes that intentional communities are pioneers in sustainable living, personal and cultural transformation, and peaceful social evolution. Intentional communities include eco-villages, co-housing, residential land trusts, income-sharing communes, student co-ops, spiritual communities, and other projects where people live together on the basis of explicit common values. Since its beginning in 1987, FIC goes about its work in a number of ways, including the Communities Directory, Communities Magazine, Community Bookstore, community-focused events, classifieds, the blog, and many more. FIC's passion is promoting cooperative culture and sustainable living. That means providing the information and inspiration for those seeking community, forming communities, struggling with the challenges of community, and those who want to develop a greater sense of community where they are. However community touches your life, FIC will try to help you find what you're looking for. In turn, you can help by becoming an FIC member. Well, Laird, there's some myths around intentional communities, you know, that have come out of the hippie era in the 60s, but the Fellowship for Intentional Communities didn't start until the 80s, and so it's probably not caught up in that hippie era of mythos. Tell us a little bit about the Fellowship for Intentional Communities, when it started, and why it continues.
It was built on the remnants of an organization that was started in the late 40s called the Fellowship of Intentional Communities, plural. And that was a collection of people who mostly were conscientious objectors during World War II, and many of whom served jail time. They lived in intentional communities mostly in the Mid-Atlantic states and Ohio Valley region and got together both for fellowship but also to discuss what they were learning about how to get along with each other, and in particular what was compelling for that group was what did their convictions lead them to understand about how problems could be solved without resorting to war as a tactic after being horrified at what happened in the loss of life in World War II. That group did not develop programs and did not last past a certain. By the time the 70s came along, they were a remnant, not really something vital. They never really developed programs or had any way to generate money or didn't try to sell products or services. We became aware that there was a group of us who were involved in our own intentional communities in the 70s and 80s and saw the benefits of having more information gathered in one place about what was going on, also the ability of people to get together to share stories about how they weathered certain storms or dealt with certain issues, technical support that might be a benefit to different communities. So that collection of burning souls, you could say, got together in the late 80s to discuss the idea of a national organization or a continental organization. And we decided to revive the FIC, although we changed its name when we incorporated in 1986. We changed the preposition as well as changing it from plural to singular, so it became the Fellowship for Intentional Community, the idea being we were expressly inviting people who supported the concepts but may not be living in intentional community themselves. So it was an organization not just for those that had already crossed the line into shared living with others, but those who were interested in it. This was a completely new cast of characters. So that is the group that got together and reincorporated with the slightly changed name, while it was somewhat inspired by the work that had gone before. This was entirely new people. There was no overlap with the remnants of the old group when we got started. But it does have that history, that link. our first project that we took on was developing a directory of communities. There had been a number of those that had been done before. However, we thought, well, one of our advantages was that we were networkers that were from all over the country rather than from just one particular location. So we had many more connections or links, references, you know, people that might know us and respond to us than any single group could have. So we started that, and our first project, the first directory we produced was done in 1990. Up until then, I think mostly people hadn't heard of us or knew what we were doing. And it was a little bit uphill at the first because almost all communities have experiences with researchers or academics, that kind of thing, trying to ask questions for papers they're writing or projects they're doing. And there's a kind of a steady trickle of that is difficult for the communities. They often don't see much benefit to it, so they're asked to contribute without much coming back, and they get a little jaded about those requests. So when we reached out and said, well, we're wanting to put together a directory, it didn't sound that different from a lot of other requests, and we were an unknown quantity for the most part. We benefited from the personal connections we had, but we were reaching out beyond what those were to be as ecumenical as we could be. However, over the years then, at doing that and continuing to do it and updating the book, we became known as somebody who actually did the projects they said they were going to do. And what's more, the communities, especially those that were looking for new members, benefited enormously by having up-to-date information available that was not trying to slant things in a certain way. That is, it was very important to us as an organization that we were even-handed in what we put out there. The only conditions we placed on our directory were three: that the communities listed did not advocate violent practices, they did not try to hold members against their will, that is, people could leave freely if it wasn't working out, and the third piece was that there was no misrepresentation, that is, what they said about themselves was true, so that you didn't get false advertising. And so we purposely set it up that people who received the directory or looked at it, it was basically, we're trying to help consenting adults figure out what associations make sense for them. Over the years, we got involved with trying to help people think intelligently about what questions to ask in order to find a good fit, but we didn't try to steer them in a certain direction. As you may be aware, intentional communities have a very wide range of common values that people come together around, and that could be spiritual, could be ecological, economic, social, environmental, or any combination of those things. So there's many, many different ways it's put together. The key is simply, well, what do you stand for? You're looking for people who share those values. You want to live with people who hold those same beliefs, and we're a vehicle for getting that information out there for people to find each other. Now, to be fair, in that search, there's really two main challenges to finding a good fit in community. One of them is served very well by our directory, which is the objective piece of what are the values you stand for. The second piece, though, the directory doesn't help with very much, which is, are these my people? Is this the tribe I belong to? And that you're going to have to actually meet the people. You can have personality clashes that don't work at all, even though you share common beliefs. And it's very difficult to discern that by reading somebody's listing. You're going to have to do the work of actually getting to know the people to find out whether you've got a fit that's going to really be your home. And we knew that, and we could help people who bought the directory to understand those differences and the limitations of what we offered. But still, there was nobody else offering what we did, and that became the backbone of what FIC stood for. Over the years, then, we added other things. The first directory was done in 1990. We became the publishers of Communities Magazine in 1992 and brought it back into regular production by 94, so that it's quarterly. And now, although that magazine was started in 1972, and we became the publishers 20 years later. Now, today, a majority of the issues have been published by FIC. We've been continually the group that's put that out as a consistent quarterly since we got into regular production in 94. We also do events. We don't do them in a regular basis. It's somewhat periodic, depending on what energy we've got and what partnerships we can form with other groups. But we regularly do events that are focused on the theme of community, which includes both how to get information about how to do community or what's out there, as well as how to solve certain problems, and then also to get a sense of community through the events themselves, that we try to create a community-like atmosphere that people are immersed in when they're attending those events. And that's something that's core to our program mix. We've also, over the course of our history, since we got started in the late 80s, that was really the front end, even ahead of our times, ahead of the real emergency of the World Wide Web and Internet stuff. So we started still in paper era and then made the transition to email and electronics. And what was a novelty at the front end of our existence is now the superhighway. So 98% of our contacts are electric today, electronic. And people visiting our website is the main way we deliver information, rather than we get almost no physical mail anymore. We still get a flow of some phone calls, but we're doing the same delivery of products and services we did, but we're doing it much more through electronic means than where we started. So we've had to change with the times, like anybody else. And today we're getting inquiries. I think it's 2,700 unique visits to our website a day, with the average visitor requesting 7 pages from us. So we're supplying a tremendous flow of information, even though those are one of the challenges for us is how to monetize that work. Since when you had a book form that you sold, well, you'd have the sale of the book to help pay the labor to create the book and then the staff to fulfill orders. With electronic stuff, it's a lot of the information is free. And then we still have the challenge of how do we pay the people that organize it and make it available. But we're, you know, figuring that out through advertising and different methods. So we've had to reinvent ourselves in terms of our business model from where we started to where we are today. However, the demand for information about cooperative living has only increased over the entire time that we've been. I mean, we've essentially been around for a generation. We're in our 28th year now of regular operation, and the interest in not just community living, but say cooperative living, how to solve problems in a cooperative way rather than a competitive way, just keeps getting stronger. People are increasingly dissatisfied with both the alienation and the competition, the hierarchy, the adversarial dynamics of the mainstream culture, and they want more civil, more connected, more belonging. That's at the heart of community, a relationship-based society rather than a monetary-based society. And that has high resonance today. And so that's the business we're in, is how to provide the skills and inspiration for cooperative living. I'll pause there and see where you want to go.
When I was the head of alternatives in the late 90s, we sold your directory in the Alternatives Bookstore, as well as subscriptions to Communities Magazine. So we've had very positive feelings about the fellowship. One thing I learned very early on is that there is no one definition of intentional community. Just like we use the word voluntary simplicity, there's no one definition for that either. But I want to challenge you a little bit here now. Let's say we had a small group of wealthy survivalists. You know, would they qualify to be a member of the fellowship?
Well, we would. I mentioned there are a few boundaries that we place, and one of them is around not advocating violent practices. So when you say survivalist, you might be crossing a line. It depends on how it's interpreted. But if they're preparing to repel people with guns and ammunition and stockpile, then we'd be talking about violent practices as a possibility. So if that were so, then that might be a basis for saying this isn't really the groups we're trying to promote. And it depends. I mean, we would ask those questions and see where the group went. Also, I would say that survivalist groups tend to, whether they're wealthy or not, tend to not want to be in association with a lot of other communities. They want to keep a low profile. They're kind of trying to be fly below the radar and you know keep those assets or that opportunity available to only a very select and well-screened set of individuals. And so we don't get much participation from survivalists because we're about putting information out and letting people, you know, sort themselves out. And so we don't tend to run into that very much.
Thank you. Well, let me give you a couple of other examples. My colleague with the One Earth Project lives in co-housing. The four adults live together in co-housing in San Diego. They bought this house together, and they live together. They cook together, eat together. I'm assuming that would qualify as an intentional community.
In our mind, it's basically whether the group of people wants to wear that label, if that feels comfortable for them. There are a large number of group houses that exist, you know, in other words, unrelated adults living together under one roof, and they come in lots of forms and sizes. Many of them are simply economic arrangements, and that is, it's cheaper that way than everybody owning their own or renting their own space. That is, the degree of connection among the people in the house can vary widely. Sometimes it's the owner lives there and is simply renting out rooms to make things less expensive and more agreeable to the people that live there. So when do you make the transition from that sort of simple economic arrangement to something that's got purpose together? And that's a fuzzy line. And so from our end, it's basically if you consider yourself an intentional community, that's good enough for us. If you're not comfortable with that, we're not going to force that label on you.
Okay, thank you. I'll give you a couple of other examples. Rita and I hosted African refugees, a mother and her two children, for about a year and a half in our home. About 5 years later, we had a relative who was sort of down on her luck, poor health, and she lived in our house for about 9 months while she found the job and recovered her health. And then most recently, we're hosting a recovering alcoholic, a man in his mid-30s, a part-time job. You know, he's just paying utilities, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Would that qualify us as part of an intentional community?
Well, there are definitely communities, intentional communities, that would have a mission that would match up well with the kinds of things you were describing you and Rita are doing in your home. So, like for instance, Catholic worker groups are a whole cadre of Catholic-inspired groups that they focus on homeless issues. And so they have a facility with members that live there that are providing, their service angle is providing opportunity and food and basic shelter for homeless people. And that is, the homeless people don't tend to become members of the community, but they're serviced by it. And so the key thing, I guess, from where I sit is, I mean, you may be doing great in the world with all the different activities you're doing, but to make it a community is a question of, is it more than just you and Rita making decisions about what's going on in the house and what direction you're going? And which I'm not saying you're required to in any way, Jerry. It's more a question, though. To be a community, it needs to be more than two people, I think.
And is there any duration involved? Does it need to be long-term?
Well, we would use the term, if you've got a dream of being a community, that is, you're intending to be one, we would just label you a forming group. If that is, you're new, your numbers are small, and then at a certain point, probably more than four people that are living together and involved in the direction of the group and in terms of defining what the group stands for. If you get to that level and you've been around for a couple of years, then that's kind of the boundary between forming and established in our minds. And it's an approximation, but that's what we use.
Now, what does it take for someone to join Fellowship for Intentional Community? You mentioned it could be people who are not actually living in community, but that are interested.
It's simply an annual fee. There's a rate for individuals, there's a rate for organizations, there's a rate for groups, which is, the group rate is based on size. And then that gets you access to information. It gets you discounts on products and services. And it's a way of showing support for what we, you know, that say, hey, we believe in this flow of information. And we understand our membership fees will help make it possible for us to pay the bills that, you know, pay the salary for the people that do the work. And so it's basically just wanting to join, which can happen. Probably the most common way now is just online.
And you have a beautiful website, IC.org, which is theoretically intentionalcommunity.org.
Right.
And it's a beautiful site, you know, well laid out, easy to follow. I noticed on there, for example, that you have a blog. Is this mm-hmm. something that someone writes, or is this a communal effort?
I think there's two different versions here, and so it depends on which you're referring to. I do one personally that was started in December of 2007. That was the prime motivation was to help drive traffic to the FIC site, although it's turned into more of a personal journal as somebody who's very active in the community's movement. So I'm not strictly writing about my life in community, although that's the bulk of what I write about, either about communities or community dynamics, which also happens to be a consulting business I do. However, I also write about my life and as somebody who's steeped in community. So that's a personal blog that I'm putting something out every 3 days. And so now I'm almost to 900 entries at, you know, almost, let's see, that would be almost 8 years into it now.
Wow.
In addition to that, there's the FIC hosts a blog where we'll take entries or submissions from many different places and post them on there. I don't manage that. Sometimes it's my writing that gets in there, but many people's is considered for it. So I'm not sure which you're referring to, but both are available through the FIC site.
So give us some numbers, Laird. How many members do we have now of the FIC? How many groups? How many communities?
Well, we've got in the directory, the online directory, the most, you know, current piece that we've got, I think it's something like 1,600 groups in the United States. There's quite a bit more than that internationally, but we really focus on U.S. and Canada as our primary geography. And there are other groups in the world that specialize, say, in Europe or Australia. And we're happy to get those, but we don't make the effort to collect them in the same way we do in the North American region. So that would include a lot of forming groups, which means there's a fair amount of instability to the numbers because, as you can imagine, a lot of startups don't succeed. It's kind of like new restaurants that a lot of people have the dream, but it doesn't mean they're gonna make it. And we made the decision early on that we would include forming groups because a lot of times it's crucial at the front end to getting somebody's attention and getting additional energy can make or break whether a group succeeds. So even though we know that leads to a fair amount of dead wood in the listing because you can imagine somebody gets excited and they want to list and we'll say, okay, that's fine, we'll list you as a forming group. And then they don't necessarily tell us when they dissolve. And so it takes us a while sometimes to figure out that, oh, this group isn't there anymore and we need to take it down. So the 1,600 is not all stable, solid groups. It includes a lot of hopes rather than reality. Now that's that number's growing. It's been constantly growing over the 28 years that we've been in business. And now there's a couple things that are going on there to help frame it. Even though we only had listings of like 300-400 groups in 1990 when we did our first directory, two things that mitigate against that. It was much more difficult to get information in the pre-internet. I mean, 1990 was not. We didn't have a robust internet service at that point, and so it wasn't. You didn't see a lot of information transmitted anywhere near like it is today. So it was more challenging. You had to. I mean, you were sending letters. You were getting letters in the mail. The response rate was lower because it took more work. The other piece is we were, and I mentioned this earlier in this call, that we were more unknown, and now we're much more established, and so we get a much higher response rate now because people trust us. And it took us a while to build that reputation. So it's both easier to respond and we're more trustworthy, and that helps with the response rate. So it's that artificially inflates what's out there. It was always there on some level, but we didn't hear from those groups in the early years that we do now. Okay, now in terms of membership, I think we have something like 150 communities that are members, and then probably that same number, similar number, excuse me, of individuals who are not affiliated with the community. So it's not a huge number, but it's still an important number to us. Membership fees represent about 10% of our budget. So it's a significant chunk and very central to us being able to balance our budget.
Well, now, you're the executive secretary. Does that mean like you're the inspector general? Do you travel around act as a cheerleader?
Well, I am a cheerleader. I'm not really the inspector general. I am the main administrator, which means, you know, I'm in the middle of the wheel and a lot of stuff flows through me, and I'm trying to make sure that I'm troubleshooting to see if something's not flowing the way it ought to or somebody's got a problem. I'm one who would take primary responsibility for things like this, which would be handling press inquiries. I often represent FIC at other organizations' events, so I do some public speaking. I do a fair amount of, I'm the one who like drafts agendas for board meetings, that kind of thing. Now, it happens that I've been involved the entire 28 years with FIC, and this year is going to be my final year in the middle of the wheel. We've already divided my job into two parts. One of them, where we've hired a development director to handle the fundraising end of my job, and then there's somebody else who's going to replace me as the executive director by the end of the year. And so these people have been identified, and I'm actively training them right now. I will still be involved in FIC, but it's time for me to let younger blood into the middle.
Excellent. Any final thoughts, Laird?
Well, these are exciting times. I mean, I think that one of the most important things FIC did was back in 2005, which now is 10 years ago, we purposely made the decision to expand our mission beyond promoting or providing technical assistance to intentional communities, which has always been our core mission, to what we call creating community where you are. The idea being that we're in the cooperative culture business, not just the community business. All right, because what we realized is there are maybe 100,000 people in the United States who live in some form of self-identified intentional community. However, there are, if you asked a different question, if you asked how many would like a greater sense of community in their life than they have now, we believe we could get 100 million people in the United States that would say yes to that. I mean, the numbers of people who remember a greater sense of connection in their neighborhoods and homes when they were children than they experience now, they see it as a degradation, and they would like to recapture it but don't know how in some ways. And we believe that the experience of intentional community is going to be powerful in the society, not so much because that's how people will live, but because people can use what we're learning about how to do that and export it or import it, depending which angle you're looking at, into workplace, church, schools, and neighborhoods, so that we can have a greater sense of community, even if it doesn't bear the adjective intentional in front of it. So that's a much bigger challenge for us and the one that we're eager to get traction on.
You've been listening to my conversation with Laird Schaub, Executive Secretary of Fellowship for Intentional Community. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to feedback@simplelivingworks.org or simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. You can share them also on our Facebook page or at the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. For details about some change of focus for the Simple Living Works blog, listen to the previous episode of this podcast and also read some recent blogs. Had a nice response from Colleen Vachuska. She said, "Hello, Jerry. I was a member of Alternatives for Simple Living for a time. Though I'm not a religious person, I appreciated its message and ideals. When the letters, catalogs, and emails stopped coming, I kind of wondered what happened. I'm glad to see that you're still around and have embraced a new business model. Making information freely available seems very appropriate for an organization that advocates for simpler living. So kudos to you and best wishes for your work going forward." Thank you, Colleen. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice Access them at simpleLivingWorks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, at iTunes. It's a project of the One Earth Project. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. Find details in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Then click About. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. If you're new to Simple Living Works podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen to a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. And we issue at least 1 blog per week. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.